Talkers.
Welcome to Speak and Destroy, Episode 4. I am your host, Ryan J. Downey. Speak and Destroy is a podcast about all things Metallica, by Metallica fans, for Metallica fans. This episode, I'm digging into my personal interview archives for a lengthy, in-depth conversation with the metal god himself, Rob Halford, frontman for Judas Priest. Priest, of course, was a massive influence on Metallica, and the two bands have a friendship that goes back a number of years, and a lot of mutual respect and admiration for one another and what each band has accomplished and contributed to the great cause of heavy metal. Halford, of course, whether it was with his first post-Priest band, Fight, which was very almost sort of Pantera-inspired, to the band that he did called Two that was on Trent Reznor's Nothing Records imprint of Interscope that was much more experimental and sort of industrial. He's got a diverse range of taste and opinions. He also knows a lot about metal. I mean, the guy is just an ambassador for this, for the whole culture, the community. Everything metal is defined by Rob Halford. I mean, Halford's the guy who brought the, you know, leather boy BDSM shop look from England and from bars and nightclubs onto the heavy metal stage. I mean, when you think leather studs, spikes, that's Rob Halford. That's Judas Priest. And that, thanks to Rob Halford, is synonymous now with heavy metal music and culture. Halford is always in the know about up-and-coming metal bands. I mean, the guy likes Emperor. He likes August Burns Red. He likes Whitechapel. The latter two bands both come up in this conversation you're about to hear. I sat down with Rob Halford in August of last year at the Musicians Institute here in Hollywood, California. Musicians Institute has been kind enough to have me on hand for their conversation series, which has been a series of Q&As with different artists over the last couple of years. Absolutely, hands down, my number one favorite was getting to do this Rob Halford Q&A. What you're going to hear, it's Rob Halford and I going very in-depth into the history of Judas Priest, talking about everything from the PMRC trial to the Turbo record. And this is in front of an audience of rabid Priest fans. Now, the audience isn't necessarily mic'd, and yet you can still hear their excitement through Rob's mic and my mic. And then there's some Q&A towards the end where we take some audience questions. It was a very wide-ranging conversation. It was so much fun. I had an opportunity to meet Halford backstage at the Alternative Press Music Awards last year, where he performed with Baby Metal. I also got to interview Baby Metal and Halford together, but just talking with him a little bit during the show backstage and about how we'd be getting together for this MI conversation thing. I know everyone says this about him, and let me just be the millionth person to put it out there. Such a gentleman, such a badass, such a legend, so cool, so down to earth, really interested and curious. You know, sometimes when you meet a legendary, iconic frontman for some massive band, sometimes they're really cool, but that doesn't mean that they're interested in you. They're just kind of cool to the extent that you're interested in them. But Halford's a guy that has questions, you know, and tells amazing stories and wants to hear your dumb stories. I got to see Halford perform with Metallica at the Revolver Golden Gods Awards a couple years ago. My good friend Josh Bernstein, huge coup for him, getting Metallica to headline that thing. And of course, you know, something that would always happen at that show traditionally is bands would have guests and do these duets. And Metallica brought up Halford for Rapid Fire, one of the greatest Priest tracks. They had Halford on stage again when they did the multiple night stand in a small venue, you know, small for them, in San Francisco for their 30th anniversary a few years ago. That's actually available if you want to go buy an MP3 of that from the Metallica website. There's so much, there's a trove of Metallica live recordings from every stage of their career going all the way back on their website. I recommend getting all those 30th anniversary shows with all those guests. They had King Diamond, Geezer Butler, Ozzy Osbourne, Glenn Danzig, you know, guys from Death Angel, so many guests and such a deep dive into their catalog. But certainly having Halford there again was a treat both for them and for all of us fans.
Second to none.
I was thrilled and amazed and ecstatic to get to see Metallica's secret show during San Diego Comic-Con a couple of years ago. They were there promoting the Through the Never 3D film, which was had either just come out or was about to come out. I got to sit down and speak with Kirk Hammett for a good amount of time for an interview for MTV News, and then was able to score some tickets to go see them in like a 1,200, 1,500 cap room in San Diego. So, of course, you know, a show like that during an event like Comic-Con, you know, the guy who plays Daryl from The Walking Dead was there. Of course, Brian Posehn was there. You know, you look around and you see these people. I saw Bradley Cooper. The dude was rocking out the entire time, playing air guitar, air drums, knew all the words. He is a legit Metallica fan. I've seen him at Metallica shows since then. I think I've actually talked about that on the podcast already. He's the real deal when it comes to Metallica fans, which is awesome to know because he's a cool actor. My point, though, is that Rob Halford was at that show, and seeing him in the balcony sort of adjacent to where my friends and I were, I mean, it just, you know, obviously blows away any other quote unquote, you know, celebrity sighting at a show like that. But man, getting to watch Metallica in a small room, blowing my eardrums out, being super psyched, being with some of my best friends at that show, and being able to look over and see Halford watch Metallica while I'm watching Metallica. Just total fan bliss and amazing. A couple of things quickly before we dive into this interview. Rolling Stone has put up a list of the 100 greatest metal albums of all time. First of all, I would just direct you to go there. My buddy Corey Grau, who's one of the writers there, was a huge part in this. I assume he probably spearheaded it. He's definitely like the metal dude there these days. It's a great list. You know, lists are made to be argued over. No one's ever going to be totally satisfied by them. You're always going to be mad about something that was included or something that was excluded or the placement of this or that or why one particular record from a band is on there and not another, and so on. I would recommend going to rollingstone.com and reading a little bit about how they put this list together. They've also been unleashing a series of podcasts with some of the people who contributed to that list, as well as some of the individual lists from some of these individuals. One of the first ones that went up was Lars Ulrich's list. Lars Ulrich's top 15 metal records of all time. He kind of took the gentleman's way out by putting them in alphabetical order instead of listing them by order of preference. But you know, he's got Guns N' Roses, Appetite for Destruction on there, Alice in Chains, Dirt, Deep Purple, of course, Iron Maiden, Number of the Beast. And right there on that list is Judas Priest, Unleashed in the East. This is what he says. This is Judas Priest at their early peak. With a lot of harder rock and European bands, there came a point where they wanted to crack the American market and started writing singles, shorter songs, and not necessarily in a bad way, but some started deviating from their point of origin. This is just Judas Priest at their absolute best in a live situation before they hit singles. There's a lot of deep cuts on it from Sad Wings of Destiny. Obviously, there's the legendary Victim of Changes. It's just the energy and the chugging riffs and downpicking, like with Deep Purple's Highway Star in it. They were probably the first band, along with AC/DC, that had two guitars that were playing the same thing. Other bands like Motorhead and Deep Purple had one guitar player and they were doing different things, more of a layering thing, but when it came to Judas Priest, they had the guitars coming together and playing the same riff. It just doubled it up and gave it a heavier, bigger sound and made it thicker and more immersive. And he goes on to say more about Unleashed in the East, and you're welcome. I didn't try to do a Lars accent or impression right there. So shortly after that went up, you know, a day or two later, Rolling Stone put up the personal list from Rob Halford, his 10 favorite metal records, and he actually did put his in order. His number one record was Black Sabbath's self-titled debut album, you know, which is hard not to put at number one, given its historical importance and the fact that it is essentially, for all intents and purposes, the first heavy metal album. Right behind it at number two, Metallica's Kill 'Em All, which he says was full-on thrash energy that led the USA charge. So Metallica's debut right there, right behind Black Sabbath's debut on the Metal Gods top 10 metal albums of all time. Amazing. Which reminds me, I'm giving away a deluxe collector's edition reissue box with the hardcover book and all sorts of extras of Metallica's Kill 'Em All, courtesy of my friends at Warner Music. As soon as we've got 100 reviews on iTunes, I'll either have a little team of judges pick the best review, or we may even just pick it at random, but someone who writes a review in the iTunes store of Speak and Destroy is going to win this collector's edition numbered deluxe Metallica Kill 'Em All box set, courtesy of Warner Music. Reviews matter, because the more reviews there are, the higher the visibility in the iTunes store, and the more people will discover Speak and Destroy. I'd like to give a shout out to all my friends and the whole team at the Musicians Institute in Hollywood, a great school, a place that puts on great events for their students and for the public. It's been my honor and my pleasure to host a number of Q&As there, and again, this one being one of my, if not my number one absolute favorite of them so far, Rob Halford of Judas Priest. If you want to see a video version of this, it's broken up into 5 or 6 parts. It's available on YouTube. You can go find it. But for now, enjoy my in-depth Q&A with Rob Halford of Judas Priest from late last year. Here it is. The man that I'm about to bring out needs no introduction, but I'm going to introduce him anyway. Two words. Metal. God. Metal. God. Metal. God. Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Rob fucking Halford. Already, you've out-rowdied any other crowd we've had for one of these. As advertised. So if you haven't been to one of these before, a little bit about what we do is we just have a very fun conversational discussion about really a wide-ranging number of things, going all the way back to the origins and figuring out, in this case, how one becomes the metal god. And then we'll take some questions from y'all, so be sure to come up with some good ones. And I'll let you know when it's time for that. Yow!
I was saying backstage, I think I'm having the male menopause this evening. Whatever.
Hot sleeper.
Yes. Thank cool. you.
Sir.
Hello, Ryan. I saw Ryan 2 weeks ago.
Yep.
At the baby metal thing.
Did you guys see Rob Halford with Baby Metal? I saw
that was pretty cool.
Check.
A lot of people hated me after that, you know. Which is, whatever. My philosophy in life is do everything that you want to do and don't let nobody try and stop you. Because, you know, you're living your life for yourself, and that can be kind of dangerous territory in the music world, because our fans, who I love with all my heart, are like family, and when you're in a family, you're very opinionated. What is he wearing? You know, that kind of yeah. thing.
It's like
what
people with baby sports metal? Teams.
No, you know? I just want to do it because they asked me, and I think they're pretty cool, and that was that. So, end of story. Then he got to Blabbermouth. There's like 5,000. Fuck you. Fuck you. Fuck you.
But for every 5,000 fuck yous on Blabbermouth, there's 500,000 people that saw it and went, "That's fucking cool," and didn't say shit. So, I always like to keep that in mind. So one of the things that I'm really interested in talking with you about that's been a fascination of mine as a lifelong fan of heavy metal, what makes Birmingham so fucking metal? Like, how, what was it about this place, this soil, this industrial, that produced all of these legends like yourself?
You know, I really feel blessed that I was born and raised in that part of the world, because there are lots of discussions about where heavy metal came from. What was the first heavy metal sound? Some people say it was Blue Cheer when they did Summertime Blues, which is a really, really heavy track. But in essence, for me, it was when Tony detuned his guitar after the accident, and those first really heavy riffs started to come out from him, from Birmingham. But you've got to try and put your mindset back to a place. When I was born in 1951, that we still kind of had the residual effect of World War II, that horrible World War II. So a lot of the UK was recovering, you know, rebuilding from all the terrible destruction. And so it was with Birmingham. And Birmingham at the time was kind of becoming this shining mecca of concrete and steel, which was a great thing to talk about until you actually saw it, you know, and they actually tried to make it a modern city by building a freeway that went through the heart of the town, thinking everybody's going to stop. But they didn't. They just kept going south to London, you know, which was a disaster. But because I think we were, musically, we were coming through the back end of that really incredible electric rock experience, a lot of it coming from America. Maybe. Hendrix, for example, was the first guitar player that really turned things up, you know, because technology was advancing and Marshall amplifiers were being made and everything was getting louder and more intense and crazy. And so, you know, growing up and living through those early developmental times of Birmingham and the New England, like a lot of kids, I was trying to find my place in music. What did music mean to me? You know, what could I get out of the music that I was listening to? And even then, I was drawn to anything that was louder than anything else, Lemmy. Yeah. So it was just that sense of wanting to break out, you know, get out of the hood, the neighborhood, whatever you want to call it. You know, there was that part of the UK that was still pretty bleak, you know, even though it was growing.
I think it was fair to call that a hood at that time.
Yeah, so, you know, it was just like a lot of musicians, the music gives you an ability to be free. When you play in a band, you have this incredible sense of escapism and freedom. And I think that's what a lot of the players around the Midlands were doing, not only metal, because we had like the Moody Blues from there, and obviously Robert from Zeppelin and ELO, The Move, all of these incredibly talented musicians that were just, like most musicians, trying to break free. But I don't know what it was. I think the other reason for me was always that when the Beatles became famous, they were from Liverpool. And in that time, you had to go to London to be a success. But they said, no, we're from Liverpool, you know. And when they became famous, I think that sent a message to musicians all over the UK that you didn't have to be from the Big Smoke, as it used to be called. You could, you know, you could find your fans, you could find a club, a place to play. You didn't have to go like 200 miles south. Yeah. So
the tradition carried on by like Oasis and Morrissey and
that's right.
About so Manchester.
Yeah, exactly. So the whole thing, this dividing line that still is there in the UK, you know. Once you go north of the Watford Gap, as it's called, there's something supposed to change, which I never quite understood that. You know, you're going back to the class system, you know, upper class, middle class, lower class, and it was a terrible thing, a struggle in the UK. It's not so much now, but it still hints a bit there. So all of those things compounded, I think, Ryan, were the result of bands like Priest and Priest and Sabbath, you know, wanting to make a noise, and it happened to come from the Midlands.
And the world was forever changed for the better for a lot of us. So who were some of the, you know, you mentioned Hendrix. What were some of the things that you found early on that really gave you that fire to say, I want to create something like this or something that evokes this same feeling?
It's funny you should say that word fire, because I instantly get a guy in my head going, the crazy world of Arthur Brown, who had a song called Fire. And he used to make appearances on this TV show we used to have called Top of the Pops, which is a bit like American
Sure.
Bandstand.
Yeah.
And this guy was insane, you know. I mean, nobody had ever seen anything like him. He was like Rasputin, the Mad Monk. And he used to wear a crown of fire on the television, you know, This is before anybody's, before Ozzy and Manson, and, you know, everybody's like, well, get that thing off the television. You're corrupting the children of England and all that kind of thing. It was incredible. So I was drawn to that, like most young people. I want that. That's the guy. That's the guy there. You know, I don't want the other thing that's too soft and tame, you know? So, and I actually saw him. I saw him do a show in my hometown is Walsall, which is about 9 miles away from Birmingham City. And I actually saw him perform at a college, I think it was. And he had a full-on show, you know. I don't know where he got these incredible people to make, like, galleon fighting ships. The roadies would dress up as galleon fighting ships, and they'd just go crashing into each other while he was singing around them, just doing all this crazy psychedelic rock and roll stuff. And so that was me. I loved anything that had spectacle, that left you with a visual memory as well as an audible memory. So yeah, you know, the loud people, whether it was Arthur Brown or obviously what Hendrix was doing. From a musical point of view, I was always drawn to really talented players, you know, like the Cream with Eric Clapton and Ginger Baker and Jack Bruce, that kind of stuff, you know. Anything, but still now to some extent, I love to listen and look at people that have really put some time into doing what they're doing, you know. That's why I love lead guitar players. I love Richie and I love Glenn and Keke, the way that they really work hard to make things special, you know. So a mixture of all of those people. And it wasn't always heavy. So as a singer, I've always had a very open mind to appreciating every kind of vocal performance. Yeah.
And that was actually my next question. What made you decide that your voice would be your instrument versus, you know, picking something else up in a band?
I don't know. Again, I guess just because a lot of musicians, we kind of emulate each other. You know, what is a heavy metal singer? I mean, what was a heavy metal singer in 1969, you know?
I mean, if someone asked me what is a heavy metal singer, and I'm not just saying this because you're sitting here, I say Rob Halford. So what was her before that was, you know?
When I...
I mean, I'm not, you know...
The reason I'm saying that is that, again, musicians always look to... We always look to each other, you know. Guitar players look to certain guitar players, drummers, bass, whatever. But as far as metal singers, I personally didn't have any. I didn't go that. I love what that metal singer's doing over there, because there wasn't any. You know, there wasn't any. Yeah. I mean, I'll always put my friend Robert Plant at the top of the heap for me, only because he just went the extra 9 yards when he started, you know, wailing and screaming and doing stuff that not many of the male vocalists at the time were doing. He was a great inspiration for me. So again, I can remember those very early days of Priest where we used to rehearse at this little, tiny little room about half the size of this stage. We could barely get in it. And it used to be run by this local vicar. We called him Holy Joe. His name was Joe, Father Joe. And it cost us about £5, which is a lot of money in those days, £5. And we used to give him £5, and he'd go straight down the pub around the corner and get smashed out of his mind. Seemed staggering back into the church, you know, to the late night service. But he used to run this room called Holy Joe's, a very famous place. Slade used to jam there all the time, and a lot of other people. It was really the only, very few rehearsal facilities in those days. So Priest would go in there, and we didn't really have an idea of what we were doing. It was very much a jam, you know. It was kind of progressive blues rock, you know, and out of those early jams would come the riffs and the ideas. So we really, I really wish now, if I'd had a cell phone to record it, and we didn't even think about pressing record on a tape machine, you know. What were we doing? You know, it would have been like watching something grow, you know, that was never heard of before. But anyway, that's that's how that sound developed, and that's how my technique, if you want to call it that, my style, if you want to call it that, that's how it developed. You literally are making it up as you go along, which I think is really cool, because that means it's very pure, you know?
And correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe Ian Hill was the first member of Priest that you met, is that correct?
Yes. He was dating my sister, Sue. She reminds me this every Christmas. Remember that time you were looking, when I was dating Ian, they were looking for a singer, and I suggested you audition to them. Yes, you've told me this about 8,000 times. God bless you. But that's how it was. I was in a local band called Hiroshima. Great name for a band. And before that, no, my best amateur band was called Lord Lucifer.
God, now that is a great name.
That's a great metal name. Isn't it a great name for a band? Lord not just Lucifer, it's Lord Lucifer. I don't know who came up with that. I wish they'd have trademarked that, you know. But and then Abraxas and then Athens Wood, all these kind of bluesy, progressive rock bands. So I was doing the circuits just around the Midlands and the clubs and the pubs, anywhere that would where you could play. And so people knew what I was able to do, and I think that's how I got the audition through my sister dating Ian at the time, and I went and met KK and talked about music, and we had a jam at Holy Joe's, and that was that.
And just to go back for just a second, you know, you mentioned that they knew what you were able to do. Can you think of a moment? I mean, the name Rob Halford is synonymous with this amazing, insane, impressive vocal range, you know, and, you know, decades before American Idol or anywhere where people were testing their metal, so to speak, you can sing this like shriek, but also this range where that's, you know, there's the low range, there's the mid range, there's the high range. Do you remember when you first discovered, like, I'm capable of doing this? Right, like,
no, not really. Again, it was just those early jams, you know. I just wanted to see how high I could go, you know. I mean, and you do that as blues singers, blues, because I love blues music. That's like, again, you've probably read on my bucket list is to at some point make a blues album, but to actually listen to those great early blues singers, you know, and. And again, try and emulate some of that into the passion and the soul, the screaming vibe out of your person. You want to go high, you want to scream as much as you can. I don't think I really found it until we made Rockarola, when we were doing Run of the Mill, that track, the ballad Run of the Mill. There's the very end section where I'm singing, I can't go on, I can't go on. And I can remember even now just talking about it. It was all very free form because it was the outro part of the track. And I just kept, you know, going higher and higher and higher. And when I listen to that now, it's pretty much of a kind of a synchronicity.
Serendipity.
Serendipity. Okay. Serendipity.
I feel like serendipitous
moment, like touchstone, catalyst, whatever it is. You know, I'm sure that musicians feel that. It just happens, you know. It's hard to describe. It's as though you're finding out something about yourself. And if you can do it by self-discovery, I think that's great, you know. I mean, now I don't think I'm as adventurous enough. That's why Glenn is always pushing me when I always do my vocal tracks with Glenn, and we'll be sitting there and I'll be doing my bit and you go, you can do better than that. Oh, take 23. I think you've got it. I think you can just do one more. Just try that one word there. So even now I love to be, you know, pushed to see. I don't think I'm lazy. I think I just need that extra kind of, you know, kick in the butt to get that thing to happen. And that might seem strange, me saying that, but that's just the way I am, you know. I've always tried to be very honest and open about what I am as a musician. And so You know, self-discovery in the early days is great because it gives you a little bit of a boost of a confidence, and it really makes you want to keep trying and trying. But then I think as you get older, I still feel that way, but, and the fire is still there. But, you know, in the early days, the fire's blazing. Now it's one of those fires where you want to take your shoes off and put your feet to. Well, that feels, that fire feels great, you know.
Poke it with a stick a little bit.
So it's more of a comfortable fire these days, and oh God, it's so hot in here. I still enjoy the adventure, the challenge of a new vocal idea and approach, and Priest is making new music right now, and and I would never talk about Priest music before it's officially time to talk about it, but there are some fucking incredible things coming from this band. Some really, really serious stuff is about to happen. I think everybody's going to be very, very happy with what we're trying to do next. And that again is always, what else can you do? After 40 something years, you can still do something different, you know, and I think that's what I love about this band, about Priest, is that we haven't kind of let go of the reins. We're still very much hungry and searching and trying to prove what we've got left inside of us as musicians. And so this next batch is going to be a real thrilling moment for everybody, I think.
And there was some talk in the not too distant past, over the span of the band's career, of the end of Priest, that I think was probably misconstrued in terms of what the parameters of that even were. But I just want to say on behalf of everyone, thank you for not ending Priest and everything you put out since then.
We, you never lose sight of the fact of where you are and how you've got to the place that you're at. And I think that's not just in music, but in everything. There's very few of us that can get through life without having some kind of a team or a person or a bunch of people helping us move ahead and achieve the things that we love. And so it is with us in Priest, you know. There's a tremendous love that we have for each other as far as, you know, musicians. And the fact that, you know, this thing about, you know, when you say you're going to do a farewell tour, please don't say that, because I'm saying that because I'm talking from experience. Before KK retired, it was going to be a farewell tour, but then when Richie came along, the incredible guitar player Richie Falconer came along, not only did he give us a boost, which is a natural thing. It's like when you change a guy on your football team or your basketball team. The team is the same, but you bring in another player and the dynamic should shift, you know, the energy should shift. And that's what happened with Richie. So the sense of, you know, longevity is still within us. I think, I don't think we're going, oh, even though the clock is ticking, we're not even thinking about the end, you know. What else can we do? You know, it's going to be more live shows and more records for the future.
Hell yeah. So I'd like to go back a little bit to when you were talking about this very natural, organic way of finding yourself, finding your sound, knowing there wasn't a blueprint to follow of, we're going to be a heavy metal band and here's what heavy metal bands do. Certainly if I were to start a heavy metal band tonight, well, we'd sound like Judas Priest and we're going to wear leather. And I'd love to hear from you, because really you're responsible for the introduction of what we think about as the look of metal when it comes to leather and spikes and chains and motorcycle boots and Harleys. And talk to me about introducing that into really the mainstream music culture.
But it was there right from... Again, that's why I always feel blessed as a musician to have lived through a time when music was such an incredible, powerful force, particularly after the Second World War, because we went through the 50s, which was a little bit of a nomadic phase, but then when the 60s came along with people like Elvis and Little Richard And then fast forward to Hendrix. All these people dressed up. It was an incredible alleged comeback performance of Elvis when he's just sitting on a stage dressed in black leather. And it's all live into the mic. It's great, you know. It's absolute godlike to watch that guy make that performance.
68 comeback special, anyone who hasn't seen it. Watch it when you get home.
Even now you could watch it and you think it was done last week. It's just, it transcends time.
And that's the part of that's the timelessness of the outfit, right?
Like, yeah, well, Jim Morrison. That's the great thing about black, dressed in black. Best color ever. Although black supposedly isn't a color, according to scientists. I don't know whether you know that. Just black thing, whatever. But what I'm saying is that, you know, everything I saw as a kid growing up from musicians, it was that I remembered not only what I heard, but what I saw. And so that was the case with Priest. You know, we had this new sound being developed. And you look at those very early pictures of Priest, and you can see we're just kind of trying to find ourselves with the imagery, because we had this loud, aggressive, in-your-face kind of music, but it just wasn't quite meshing in terms of, you look at some of the pictures in Stained Glass, and it's, you know, it kind of defies logic when you look at that. But then you move forward a record or two, and then you see that leather thing coming in, and it just makes absolute sense, you know, that you've got a very kind of strong type of defining statement visually that suggests, well, this band has got to be tough and loud and strong. So, and then of course it's been embellished a little bit since then, you know. But I think it was a good move. It was part of, as I progressed in my ideas and sitting with people and can we try this, can we try that, it became very very much part of that new metal scene, you know, right from say the mid late 70s onwards. You know, it suddenly became the thing that was a lot of other bands were looking at what Priest were doing.
That's not new with the U and the umlaut.
Yeah,
that would be the new wave of British heavy metal we're talking about.
Yes, we were before that. Yeah. Yes, I have to, I'm always very vocal about that. We were before the new wave of British heavy metal, which was a great moment because I think that really put metal on a global map, you know. It really, particularly here in America.
Those bands were influenced by Sabbath and Priest.
Yes, absolutely, yeah. You know. And again, it's a joy to look back that two of the founding bands of the heavy metal scene are still here. You know, we're still active. We may have changed shape a little bit, but the structure of us, we're still here. You know, we are the inventors of heavy fucking metal. You know.
It's funny, it reminds me, as also a fan of Iron Maiden, seeing interviews with Bruce Dickinson.
Yes.
where he'll say, hey, you know, we're not, people always say Sabbath, Priest, and Maiden. You know, we're not as old as those two bands.
Yeah, I mean, I love Bruce. We've known those guys forever, you know, and it was so exciting to see Maiden leading the charge in that new wave of British heavy metal, along with Saxon and a bunch of other great bands. But in terms of, you know, the way things get labelled and boxed in chronological order, they came through from, you know, that next level. It was a very exciting time because at that point, the exchange of information was a lot faster. Mm-hmm. You know, before the internet, before cell phones, before fax machines, you know, it was still pretty pretty extraordinary.
You mentioned Stained Glass, and I, for some reason, when I think about that record, I think about... I think that one of the biggest evangelists for that record has been Kerry King. I remember as a kid reading interviews with Slayer where he would always be talking about that record. But I think for a lot of Priest fans, and there's a lot of landmark records that we could be here all night talking about, but I would say British Steel is certainly one of, you know, if you're trying to narrow it to five or six records to introduce Judas Priest to someone, or heavy metal for that matter.
Again, when you've had the grace and fortune of having such a long life in music, that everything tends to kind of not blend into each other, but it's, you really have to sit down, you know, and somebody tell you, listen to this song, and then you listen, and then you remember, you know? And that's the case with British Steel, which has become, you know, by its own merit, just the way it was in 1980. I don't know, it's just, we made that record in 30 days from start to finish. I mean, it was just, we were flying. There was a time in the 80s, as the Priest fans say, well, no, we were banging out a record a year and a world tour. How did we do that? I don't know. When I was in the band, I just can't remember how we did it, you know.
And records of that quality, too, not just we're cranking out records, we're making Priest.
Throwing them together. It was such an exciting time, the 80s particularly. And because America was embracing metal in such an extraordinary way, you really had to keep running. You couldn't step back. You couldn't go away for a year even. The label was like, get back out, get back out. We haven't got a song, just get back out, you know. And so we would run off to Ibiza, you know, and I don't know how. Oh, God, if I think of my drinking and drugging days, but by the grace of God, I'm here, you know, because how did we do this? How did we make those records? We were smashed out of our minds like 18 hours a day, and then we'd go in the studio and make you've got another thing coming. You know, it's just mind blowing. You know, I mean, now we're like a bunch of old guys, excluding Richie. Like, well, what do we do next? Put that note after that note. That's a good idea. Whereas in those days, you fucking crank it up, you know, and we used to rent these like motorcycles, these Boltaco like speedway motorcycles, and it was like Ibiza in the 80s. It was like, it was hedonistic, you know. I mean, it's still a crazy place now, but my God, you know, going up the sides of mountains after drinking a bottle of vodka and dropping some acid, you know, it's just like, how did I even do that? You know, and Ian got through 12 rental cars in a week because he wanted to see how he could go through all the gears without pushing the clutch in, you know. And the guy from the rental place came up to some, I no lend you no more cars. No, we need more cars. No more cars. I show you why. And he gets an envelope out. He thought, he's bought us some coke. And he opened it up and all this white powder came out. He goes, these are the brakes. Ian, not the brakes, the thing that changes the gear, whatever. Yeah, that was, it was all ground down to fine white powder, and you threw it on the kitchen table. No more cars for you. No more cars. So all of those things happened, and we made these wonderful records at the same time, you know. And so, in the midst of all that, was the sanity of John Lennon's former house at Tittenhurst Park. Beautiful, beautiful, stately home. And again, we were on the, you know, running. We had to make a record pretty quickly. We finished a tour. We opened up for AC/DC, and it was the last tour that Bon did, rest his soul. And we finished the AC/DC tour, and about a week later, we went into this Lennon's old studio and started to make British Steel. And again, it's just, I don't know what it's, kismet, fate, destiny, whatever, but all...
Serendipity.
All of those songs, da 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 da, that's great, we're going to use that, you know. And da 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 da, that's great, we're going to use that. It was very spontaneous, and again, I think some of the purest music comes from in being instant, and again, organic, which is one of Richie Falcon's favorite word is organic. If you see him, just like, have you had anything organic today, Richie? but in the true spirit of these wonderful things that happen to you as a musician, and you really can't explain why, you know, Glenn put his fingers where he did on the guitar, you know, or where did I... these lyrics come from. It's just this beautiful, free-flowing type of musical experience. And I think probably out of that, if you look through the great history of rock and roll, all kinds of records kind of pop up because of those moments. It's just a beautiful, pure experience musically, and I think that was the case with British Steel. We had the fire burning around us at the time in the UK with Margaret Thatcher, and the coal miners were on strike, and the garbage men were on strike, the steel workers were on strike, we had the punk new wave movement going on. It was a real revolution going on in the UK at that time, both in, you know, people on the street, in government, and in culture. A little bit like what happened in America in the 60s, around the Nixon Vietnam years, you know. This is the great thing about music. A lot of great music comes out of turbulence, you know, and I think that was probably Priest's album, British Steel, which is just a great statement because it means so much, came to be at that time, and it's a good record. And it clocks in really quickly as well. You know, it's about 38 minutes and change, maybe.
It's like, you know, it's Rain bang, and Blood. Bang, bang. And like, well, so many great metal records are just, you know.
But, yeah, so I long for records like that now because I know we're in a different world and people tend to listen to music one track at a time. But it is very important if you do have the time to commit to listening to what your favourite band has made from the first track to the last track.
Because and how it's sequenced.
Yes, yeah. The sequencing. It's telling you a story of your favourite band at that particular time in their life and your life. So right from the get-go of that first track on British Steel, to the last track, is it Steeler? It's just a wonderful. When we played that live, we only played the British Steel album live in America, I believe. It was just great to play that live. It just flew by, and at the end was just like going to church. You know, it was just ooh, you know, it was great.
For me, growing up in America, you know, I discovered heavy metal and Judas Priest in the 80s. I was, you know, a kid from a working class background, broken home, the whole deal in Indiana, which was, you know, certainly not the most progressive place to grow up. And, you know, for me, I remember seeing, everyone makes the joke about how MTV doesn't play music videos, but I did see Judas Priest for the first time on MTV. And, and seeing you in the whole regalia and just, I mean, it was people use terms like mind blowing and things like that. I think they overuse it, but in that case, my mind was blown as a kid seeing Judas Priest.
Well, you know, a big shout out to what was MTV because we were there right from the very beginning of the video age, and again up until that moment, it was magazines. It really was magazines. It was radio. God bless rock and roll radio. I love radio. I always have and always will in this country. But to suddenly be able to visually have that band in your bedroom or the living room or whatever, your favorite band over and over again, you know, not only were you able to listen to the track, but you could actually see the track and whomever it might be. And MTV were tremendously responsible for spreading that that experience. I can remember going to New York City and doing some of the very first broadcasts for MTV. I was a VJ for a bit. Did you know that, Ryan?
I was a VJ.
That's like a DJ, but you're a VJ, video
jockey.
DJ, VJ. And it was crazy.
You did the I Want My MTV, those promos, right?
Yeah, I did. A bunch of that stuff. It was great, you know, yeah. Martha Quinn and all the early people.
Alan Hunter.
And there was Mark a little Goodman. Tiny building in New York, and of course, you could MTV was everywhere except for New York City because they couldn't get the cable licensing to work. So to be with those guys at the kickoff was tremendously exciting, and it was a revolution, you know.
That's how a kid in Indiana was going to see and hear.
Well, that's what
Priest.
It was. You see, yeah. it took you. You didn't. I'm going to try and explain this. You know, you could see your favorite band in your town, wherever you were in America, and that was your kind of doorway, your window to hopefully seeing them perform live, you know, coming to your town. And so for Priest, it was a blast. I can't remember the very first video we made, but was that the very first one? Was it? Was it Living After Midnight? Yeah. I remember riding...
We're crowdsourcing this factory.
I remember I wouldn't, I'd be lost without you guys. I remember riding a motorcycle out for Living After Midnight outside of Sheffield Town Hall, for Living After Midnight. That was like the entrance to the show, and it was middle of winter, it was freezing fucking cold, but everybody stood outside because they wanted to be in a video, you know, all the fans. And then, the story is you drive along and then you get on the stage and you join the band. So a lot of it, again, from the video storyboard point of view, was very new until you got people like Julian Temple. Julian Temple was a great innovative video guy. Yeah. And we made a bunch of videos with him, the famous ones being, you've got Nothing,
Temple.
Nothing oh. Coming, which we made somewhere outside of London. But so... The video experience was an extension of yourself as a band, because normally you'd be playing music, but suddenly you were an actor, you know.
I mean, I remember the Turbo Lover video was like Mad Max. Yeah,
that was great.
It was like early Tool with like
Wayne Isham and his sidekick. Oh God, two incredible guys that really grabbed the reins of that experience and made them very much into very big cinematic things. Yeah, we made Turbo, part of Turbo Love, at the old Griffith Park Zoo. We also did Locked Inside Your Love in the bear pits, the old bear pits.
I could talk to you forever, and we're going to take some audience questions here. There's a few other things I want to get to first, though. One of them is, in talking about the 80s and being a kid from Indiana, and I know that your experience with this probably was different in the UK. When you got to America, I don't know how many of you in the audience remember the PMRC. But I had an experience as a kid where, my dad and stepmom had, it basically left me to my own devices as far as music that I was discovering and things like that. And I'm, seventh, eighth grade, full on thrash metal kid with the skateboard and metal records and posters on the walls and everywhere. And this thing had happened where my stepmom was Christmas shopping, and she was at the cassette store in the local mall, and she asked whoever this guy was working behind the counter, I'm here shopping for my stepson for Christmas. And the guy says, so what kind of music does he like? And she said, he wears t-shirts that say, Slayer and Metallica and Judas Priest. And this guy just freaks out. This is in the south side of Indianapolis in 1988 or something. And, the guy's like, oh, your son's worshiping the devil. He's on drugs. He's probably suicidal. And I came home from school that day, and my dad and stepmom, who were never in my bedroom, were both literally in my bedroom, flipping through my records, pulling out lyric sheets, studying the posters on the wall, looking at everything. And I thought, partly because of what the metal community had prepared me for with the PMRC and all, I was like, well, this is where they cut my hair and send me off to some reprogramming. Cause it was like that then. I would love to know, as Rob Halford of Judas Priest, who lived through that and even, went in a courtroom over it. What was that like? How did that feel? And thank God we seem to have gotten out of that dark time in our culture.
Yeah, I mean, the first thing I always think about were the two beautiful guys that lost their lives, I don't think of anything about that. I just think about this tragic loss of two beautiful guys who were hardcore Priest fans. They loved Judas Priest, Their story got terribly twisted and manipulated. But this was a simple case, which we've seen so many times, where, a couple of young guys, they come from a family that is not the perfect family. I'm not going to go into that. But, you make a few choices, then you take those choices to an extreme, and these terrible things happen. So that's the heart of it, not only for me, but I think for the rest of us, that it's so sad to think about the loss of those two beautiful guys. Having said that, stepping off the tour bus and being told before we step off in Dallas, I think it was, that the sheriff is going to present you with a affidavit, to appear in court. We didn't know what was going on at this point. Our tour manager said, just... He's going to go, you've been served, and you just take it from him. Don't say anything. So we took, and that's how it was left. We didn't really talk much about it because we didn't know what was going on. And then, of course, we actually had to leave our home country and come to Reno, Nevada, to literally fight for our lives. It was that extreme. It was only when we met with our attorneys that they were explaining all of the different, you know, ways that this was being pursued, that we thought, this is really very, very serious, not only for the loss of those two great guys, but just the perimeter of it, about subliminal messages and First Amendment rights and all of these attacking points that really had nothing to do with anything other than these people hating the music that we made. They didn't like what we did. They thought we genuinely were a threat, you know? A bit like what Elvis went through and what Little Richard went through. And we couldn't understand that because we're guys from the UK. And we've never had, we were talking about this, Ryan. We've never had that experience in the UK. British people don't talk about music that way. They don't accuse music of doing things like that. It just doesn't make sense to the British public, you know? And please don't get me wrong, I'm not having a go at the way that, you know, certain parts of this country were involved in that, because I think a lot of it, again, a bit like what's going on now, a certain portion of society is being whipped up into this hysterical frenzy about this music being so terrible and destructive and satanistic and it's no good for you, and it was all very negative, and fear, fear, fear. And a lot of people were going, yeah, you're absolutely right, you know, because of the tragedy that was attached to it. We got to the heart of the matter pretty quickly, and once we did some interviews with CNN, and we were able to tell our side of the story, and because I think that there was this preconception that these guys were, you know, yeah, man, fuck you. You know, because we were able to really articulate our point of view and, you know, have a grain of intelligence to really exchange these discussions and explain our point of view and what do you feel about that? Tell us how you feel, you know, and they would say this, and then we'd say, well, no, this is what really is meant here. Everybody was going, oh, we got this completely wrong. You know, these are just a bunch of guys in the band having a good time, you know, and so are their fans. So then it became all of this business about this subliminal messaging, which if the judge had found for the prosecution, the aftermath of that could have been quite bleak. One of our defense people suggested that because of the so-called subliminal aspect of what this whole case was hinging on, this do-it thing, which was never there in the first place, it was just the way I was singing, and a strange, weird effect, was that, you know, before any piece of music was going to be played on the radio, the station had to make a statement saying, we disassociate ourselves from any possible subliminal music in this song, and then they put on a track by Priest. You know, and that wouldn't only be for Priests, that would be everybody. And not being hysterical here, this is what we were told, that this would, if the judge had found for the prosecution, then it would have gone through all these different levels of the court system. And it was just a mishmash, because it wasn't really First Amendment rights. It was a very unusual type of thing. It goes back to in the movies in the 50s, they'd flash some popcorn they actually used to do that, but you could see it. God, I just saw some popcorn, I need some popcorn. Well, you can't do that. You know, you can't do that with music. You know, how can something be subliminal if you can hear it? So it was a very, very difficult and very, very interesting case from a legal point of view, from a technical or audio point of view. But, you know, that wrapped up with what Tipper Gore was doing and the PMRC and stickers.
And they were putting records by Prince and Bruce Springsteen.
Yeah,
and,
it wasn't, as you
know, it wasn't just,
it
Wasp
wasn't just
and Priest, it was
Sheena Easton, everybody. I mean, I'm all for explaining preempting the content of something. I think that's common sense, you know, especially if But, you know, what are kids now? I don't know what a kid is, you know. I mean, what is a, how is an 8-year-old thinking now? How is a 10-year-old thinking now? You know, I think the thinking was in those days, you know, if there's like, if there are words on there that I don't want my family, my kids or whatever to be exposed to, I want to be able to see that that is, that there's some content like that, and I can say, I don't want this for my children. Because that, that really was the heart of the matter. And that's no different to going to the movies. Is it an R-rated movie, a PG-rated, a G-rated? We have that in the UK worldwide. So it's a very big kind of sociological, almost anthropological discussion from an artistic censorship point of view. But emotionally, it was very difficult. But, you know, we got through it. And again, with not only from the incredible defense team that we had, but the fans were just unbelievable. The fans were with us every day at that courthouse in Reno, you know, holding up posters and cheering us on and that kind of thing. We really had tremendous support from our fans, and we'll never forget that. And I always remember at the end of the trial, the fans gave me this beautiful, huge Stars and Stripes flag mm-hmm. with messages written on it, which I've still got. I've got it at my house in Phoenix. And I occasionally I look at that because it's just a great memory that that has survived that experience. And it really shows you the true strength and power and love and community of the metal community that we have, that we're always looking after each other. We always have each other's back. We always support each other no matter what we go through.
Getting a bit choked up listening to that. Yes. Sorry. Collect myself from that. I was always, as a kid even, and through adulthood, I've always believed, and I've always said, anyone who thinks that this type of music, heavy metal or punk or hardcore or anything like that, that it's driving anyone to suicide or violence or... I've always said that music was a huge part of keeping me from those things. You know, it's
yes,
thanks
it is.
To heavy
it is.
Metal.
It is. I mean, especially some of the darker themes of heavy metal. And again, some of it I'm not personally attracted to, but I'd be the last person to say, you know, stop playing that, making that kind of music. That's ridiculous. You have to allow everybody the right to express themselves, no matter how it is. You know, that's the way humanity should be. You know, that's how the world became civilized, you know. And it's important to have discourse. It's important to bump up against each other, because that's how you grow. That's how you better yourself. You know, you become a more open-minded. The wisdom starts to come in. You know, you have to be able to look at something or listen to something, and if it's not quite working for you, either put it to one side or find out what it is. You know, why is that making me feel the way I feel, you know? And really, you shouldn't do that about music. You either like it or you don't. If you don't like it, switch it off and just shut your mouth up, you know? That's just a simple philosophy.
Heavy metal, you know, taught me about H.P. Lovecraft and Edgar Allan Poe and The Rime of the Ancient Mariner and Nostradamus.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, I became way more interested and fascinated in so much literature and art, and, you know, William Blake, through metal than I ever did through the school system in Indiana in the 1980s and 90s. So, guys, we have two mics here. We can start lining up for questions. Man, I want to talk about Painkiller. I want to talk about Fight. I want to talk about Two. I wish we had several more hours, but we don't.
I will come back. This has been great, and I'll definitely come back.
Yes.
And we can talk some more.
So what we'll do here, because we don't have all the time in the world and we have a lot of awesome fans here, if you could keep it to one question. The question cannot be, can I have a hug or can I take a picture, only because that takes all
night.
Yeah,
and watch me, because as you know, I'll just go on and on and on and on. So I'm going to try and be as quick as I can.
Yeah, we'll start over here, and if you could just tell us your name and your question for Rob, and obviously, you know, try to keep it to Rob and his career, of course.
Hey, Rob. Heavy Metal Greg here. I have a YouTube channel. Electric Eye came out, and that was some very forward lyrics. Actually, if you still read through the lyric sheet of Electric Eye, you realize that there's a camera on every corner.
Yes. Before the internet and stuff.
Yeah. Yes, yes. So, I mean, the inspiration of that obviously has much more impact probably now than when it was originally written. I just wanted to point that out.
Thank you. I'm just always looking for ideas, you know. That was the great transition out of certain kinds of music. I've always loved that side of metal that can have its serious tone and can look at why are you breaking the law, you know? Well, there's a reason, you know. And Electric Eye, what does that mean? Well, we know exactly what it means now, but at that particular time, maybe some people were still trying to figure it out. But that was before we're at now, you know, and literally every aspect of our life is being recorded and looked into, and whether that's a good thing or whether that's a bad thing is a whole other debate.
These questions are the best questions we've ever had at this thing. Yes.
Oh, hey, Rob, I'm Jonathan.
Hello, Jonathan.
And I have a quick question. Just curious, what bands have you been listening to recently?
Ooh.
You are always up to date.
Do you know, I've been hibernating a little bit because I'm working on the lyrics for the next Priest album right now. There's a lot of lyrics. And when I do that, I generally tend to close things off, you know. But, God, August Burns Red.
Wow.
Whitechapel.
I'm laughing because these guys are going to pee their pants hearing that.
I just love that kind of intense attack. I was listening to, you know, those kinds of bands.
Yeah. Amen. Thank you.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi, Rob. I'm Dave.
Hello, Dave.
Before I ask my question, I just wanted to say incredibly quickly, I have an autistic 8-year-old who doesn't speak yet, and one of the only times he actually makes some kind of noise, which sounds like he is going to really speak, is when he's listening to Priest music.
That's wonderful. That's great. You see, that's the power with, you know, I read the other day about the incredible thing that this Pokemon Go thing craze is doing, that a lot of autistic children are reacting to that. So, you know, you've got Pokemon and Priest doing wonderful things for people, and that's great. I mean, that really, what you just said there says so much about the incredible power that music has.
It does.
Not just metal, but music in general. It's this beautiful human resource that is around the world, because music makes the world go round. And so that's great. And I really hope that, you know, if he keeps listening to Priest, that extra special things happen.
Thanks. Yeah. Quick question. You've had a long career, over 40 years, such great albums like Sad Wings of Destiny, Sin After Sin, you know, straight on through to now. You're making new records even now as we speak, probably. So many things have probably changed over the years with your approach, maybe like psychology-wise, philosophically. So many things have probably changed over the years. What would you say is the one thing that has remained the most consistent? Maybe something that would pop in your mind, like you might have thought about it while you were tracking the vocals to an album in the 70s, and it might still pop in your head now. Is there something that's remained consistent to your approach, whether it be technique or philosophically, throughout the ages? Something you would have thought of 40 years ago, and it still might pop in your head right now?
Well, I think it's, like we were talking about earlier, this sense of adventure that I have as a singer. I'm always thinking while I'm doing laying tracks, particularly when I'm recording. It's very difficult to sing without thinking. You should try it, because my brain won't switch off, you know. I'm a terrible insomniac. And you know, when I'm singing, there's all things are always intruding into my mind, and that's always, and that's this might sound weird, but that has always been with me as a singer. I wish it was a bit more uplifting, but it's just there. It's always there, and I think maybe that's just this internal desire, again, of just searching, you know. And I think that once the search is over, things tend to be different. And I'm glad that probably is one of the most consistent factors for me as a singer, is that I feel I'm on this fantastic adventure as a singer, and I'm always kind of looking to do something better.
Thank you.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Rob.
Yes, sir.
Hey, Rob.
Hello.
Excuse me. I'm Paul from Huntington Beach.
Hello, Paul.
Been an instant fan since about 1978, seen you in Judas Priest 30 times. Thank you.
Wow, thank you very much.
And thank you. At this point in your career, vocally, which would be the one song that you would pull out of the old archives and want to bring back on stage if you go on tour, say, next year, and which is the one you absolutely would not want to sing live again?
So are you saying a song that I've not sung or a song that I've sung?
Yes, bringing it back out of the Judas Priest.
That I've never sung. Oh, God. Oh, I tell you what I would like to do. Dying to Meet You from Rockerola.
Yeah.
I love that song. That's a really heavy song. You know, woke up this morning, something, 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 you know.
I'd like to hear Richie on it.
And then the da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. I'd love to hear those guitars now in 2016.
I would love to hear Richie on it. Like you, you just said, right?
Yeah. That would really be neat to hear. And which is the one you would never want to revise again? Why don't you just go that? Lay it to rest.
Yeah, you know, there really isn't one, in all honesty. I mean, we've always said in Priest that we would never release anything to our fans and to the public if we didn't believe in 100%. And obviously some of them do push a little bit more forward than the others. That's just the way it works. But in all honesty, everyone's a great one for me.
Should I have asked, which one would you dread singing again?
Well, I always say Painkiller, but I always rise to the bar. I always get there.
Oh, God.
You want to try singing Painkiller on the 100th? How many shows did we do on the last tour?
You killed it last tour.
100 how many? 130. When you're singing Painkiller for the 130th time, you're looking at the set list. I'm in my man cave changing into my next Liberace outfit. And I'm going, oh, God, Painkiller's coming, Painkiller's coming. I've got to do Painkiller. Oh, there's no way I can do Painkiller. Oh, God help me, I can't do Painkiller. Like,
faster than a bullet.
I'm there, you know. It's great.
And let me just say, I watched you sound check that with Baby Metal, and he was just as fucking awesome at sound check as the show.
Recent tours, you've been killing it. Thank you.
Awesome. Thank you.
Over here.
Hi, Rob.
Hello.
My name is Mauricio.
Hello, Mauricio.
Back in 92, 93, Black Sabbath reunited with Ronnie James Dio to re-record Dehumanizer. But one of the reasons that they broke up was, I guess, Sharon wanted Black Sabbath to open up for Ozzy. And then I saw an interview with Dio where he was really, you know, pissed off about it. And this was the aftermath. And I believe they got you to front Black Sabbath. I was wondering if you got any fallout. Did you get any, you know, bad relationship with Dio? How was your experience being on Black Sabbath?
God bless Ronnie James Dio. Yeah. You know, for a lot of the things that you read in the press, I remember those two shows vividly, and there was so much love going on backstage between everybody. It was just a very peculiar thing. The blessing for me, of course, was that I got to sing with my, you know, it's always been Priest first for me, then it's been Sabbath. So I've had the opportunity to do that a few times, to sing with Sabbath, and I'm singing, fucking hell, there's Tony Iommi's over there. And I'm doing like Black Sabbath and like, Satan's,
and you got to do
Satan laughing spreads his wings, and there's Geezer Butler. Yeah. Oh my God! So I don't know. It's just one of these peculiar things that happens in rock and roll, where stories get, you know, amplified in a different way. But I know that Ronnie and Ozzy did get along. You know, I mean, maybe they had a few bumps, but that's just the way it is in rock and roll. But two of the greatest metal singers ever. And I always include Ozzy. Ozzy gets overlooked. He's got a fucking amazing voice. Yeah. Ozzy's voice is sensational. You know, because, you know, it's just the way we've been led, like Ozzy Osbourne, oh, he bites the heads off bats. Well, no, he's also one of the greatest heavy metal singers of all time. You know, so if you listen to... And again, you've got to go old school. With me, to some extent, when you listen to Ozzy's early stuff, the early Sabbath albums, it's absolutely remarkable, you know. And so, anyway, there you go. Thanks.
Thank you.
I laughed when you brought that up because I was telling Rob before we came out that I have a... his manager's here. I shouldn't say bootleg, but I have a bootleg of him singing for Black Sabbath at one of those shows, and it's
YouTube
magical.
All right.
DJ Joe Rocks of our Worldwide Rocky Metal here. Just a two-part question here. Where did you come up with the name Judas Priest, and why did you use it?
Well, the band's name was already there when I joined the band, and there's always this kind of, again, urban myth thing about it coming from a Bob Dylan song, about the song of the ballad about Frankie Lee and Judas Priest. I really can't answer the question, in all honesty, but I'm just very happy that I sing for a band called Judas fucking Priest. It's Judas fucking Priest, by the way.
And you did rent a rehearsal room from a priest of some type.
Yeah.
A drunken priest.
Yeah, there's some kind of serendipity thing. You know, write a song called fucking Serendipity. Oh, God. It sounds like a Disney thing. I love Disney, by the way.
Yes.
I love Disney. Yeah. Well, it's, you know, it's escapism. It's the purest thing. There's an incredible PBS documentary about the life of Walt Disney. That man was just unbelievable. You know, it's, if you want an example of the human spirit in terms of self-belief and determination, it's worth, you know, a couple of hours of your life to watch that PBS thing. It's just sensational.
Have you been to Club 33?
Pardon?
Have you been to Club 33?
What is? Oh, no, I haven't. Yeah, there's a bit about that in the movie. Yeah,
we'll talk about that afterwards.
Yeah, it's interesting that side of it, but. I go to Disneyland about once every 3 or 4 years, and I'm just like a big kid, you know. I just can't wait to get on the rides I've been on before, and it's like the first time ever. And so, yeah, I love that Disney-esque thing.
Oh, yeah. Sir?
How you doing, Rob? My name's Tony.
Hi, Tony.
It's my absolute dream to be here right now in such an intimate setting, you know, with all these lovely people here. And it takes me right back to... my sixth grade childhood. I have my Sin After Sin tape. And I was just wondering if you have any memories recording of this album or going on tour on this album. And I think it's the most organic, like as your voice was. You know what I mean? Like your.
Thank you. Here's the deal with that record. There's been a few drummers in Judas Priest, a bit like Spinal Tap. We didn't have a drummer for Sin After Sin, and Simon Phillips did the drums on Sin After Sin, and he just turned 16. And Roger Glover from Purple, because Roger produced the album, suggested, because we were frantic. We wanted a guy that had double kick drum ability and was quite flamboyant as a drummer. And so I remember vividly making that record in London. And two other memories. One of my favorite books is Roger's Thesaurus, which sounds very posh, but it's a great book for lyricists, you know. And I was always reading this book every day. And it wasn't until the end of the session, Roger Glover came up to me and he goes, "What is that book?" And I go, "It's the Roger's Thesaurus." He goes, "Oh, I thought you were reading the Bible every day." It's not a bad idea, but... but that book is a great. I still use that now, even though you can do it all on the iPhone. I love to pick up a real book, you know, and turn the pages and read the ink. So there's that. And the other thing was, there was a world boxing match, like a super heavyweight fight going on, and I was in the studio, and Glenn goes, "It's on the television, Rob," and I shot out of my chair and ran through into the TV room and smashed the top of my head open. And it was like a Slayer thing. I was just covered in blood in seconds because your head's full of veins. And they had to rush me to hospital and put like 6 stitches, but I've still got the scar there. So those are the two or three things I distinctly remember about Synoptic.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Yes.
Hey, Rob Hopper, I'm a big fan. And,
hello.
I wanted to know, what was the inspiration behind the lyrics for Dreamer Deceiver?
Thank you, yeah. A lot of it was Hendrix-y. The purple hazy clouds are about Hendrix, Purple Haze. And I was reading something on like a scientific report about the universe and about this common theory that is that even though sound isn't audible in space, that it's there. That there's this kind of wave sound or just a particular sound that's always there. And that kind of led into solar winds. Solar winds are blowing, you know, from the sun. So it's just another aspect, like we were talking earlier on, about where you get ideas for lyrics. You know, it's just an unusual thing that you read and you go, that might be a cool lyric to put together. So the willow tree and all that kind of stuff, which just hopefully puts pictures in your mind, you know.
Yeah. It does, and it was cool to put together. Have no doubt. Thank you. Yes, sir.
Hey, Rob.
Hello.
I just want to say, it's like, you know, you've been playing for like a long time, and is there a certain ritual you have that you do before a show?
No, I don't. No. And you know, I always, in the early days, I say, yeah, I get the goat soup, the black, you know, put some UV lights on and some joss sticks and do some satanic incantations. You do that? Yeah, you got to get in the mood. Yeah, I got the evil heavy metal, bloodthirsty satanic metal before I go. And no, I just have a cup of tea and
it's like. I can attest he had a Starbucks before he came up tonight.
And then I just go out and do it.
But
that's only after years of experience. Don't try that at home.
I'm only looking at my phone because I'm getting frantic text messages that we're going to have to hurry you along if we're going to get through these questions from the powers that be.
Okay. Hey, Rob. I'm Trina.
Hi, Trina.
I hope I'm not putting you on the spot with this, but I was curious if you were for some reason banished to a desert island and you could only take one album with you. What would it be? I'm sorry.
No, it's
but
okay.
But I had to ask.
I mean, you know, my mind goes everywhere from...
Is it one of his or is it any?
It would have to
no,
be...
No, any album
oh, any
that he'd
album.
Want to listen to for the rest of his life.
Yeah. I mean, I say this with my hand on my heart and it would have to be Sad Wings of Destiny because, you know... That's what made us who we are, and I don't just mean me. I think everybody, like a lot of us in this room, it's a very important record. Thank you.
Might be mine too.
Thank you.
Nice.
Hey Rob, I'm Bailey, and I saw you in November of 2014, and before that concert, I didn't know who Steel Panther was. So how did touring with them come about?
Russ Parrish, Satchel,
Fight.
War of Words, Small Deadly Space. There was that, and a part of me thought this would just be really, you know.
The guitarist in Steel Panther was in Fight, Rob's band.
It would be just a real fun thing to do. I mean, it's very difficult to find a special guest with Priest because you guys are so fucking hardcore, you know, and we love you for that. But we just tried to do something different, and they did a hell of a job. And it was, why not, you know, we all go out to have a great night of metal and why not kind of mix it up, and I think they did a great job. They're a great bunch of guys, really, really cool guys and really talented talented players as well. And I enjoyed watching you guys' reaction because I'd be behind the scenes going, oh God, they're going to do that blowjob song in a minute. I can't wait to see what people do. Fuck you. You know.
And he's actually an MI alumni.
Yes, he is. Incredible guitar player. Yeah. Incredible.
And then their original drummer from that band is in Korn now, so.
Yeah.
Hey, Rob, my name is Tristan. So you were saying in Priest early days that you would record an album in about 30 days. nowadays, how do you find that you record songs just like one take, and like you're like, hey, this is a cool idea, and you all just come up with a song, or is it more of you resort to your library, your catch of ideas, and then take from there, kind of build off of that?
It still comes down to the really rudimentary stuff, you know. It's all about riffs. It really is about riffs and just the way the notes are arranged. And I always emphasize the melodic side of what we do in Priest. There's always melody. Even in the fiercest stuff, there's some kind of melody that you can kind of attach yourself to. So in all the years that we've been together, I don't think that's changed one bit. I've got most of the Priest album on that phone, the new Priest album.
Didn't you say you lost that phone a few minutes ago?
It's got a special code on it. But it's very rudimentary, and it is all about the simplicity of the riffs. And that would be a great challenge. Could you make another album in 30 days, you know? That would be a throwdown, wouldn't it? And I dare say that, you know, if push came to shove, we'd have a damn good go, you know. It's different in today's world that I wouldn't say that we enjoy the luxury of waiting. It's just the way that things go on in life, you know. We're still very disciplined when we go in the studio. I mean, we have set hours. We take the weekends off. We have set hours. We get there. We do the work for the day, and then we leave, you know. And that's part of, I think it's important as a musician to have that sense of responsibility, not only to yourself as a musician, but to your bandmates, because we're all in this together. You know, everybody's as important as everybody else. Everybody has something valuable to share, and ideas are popping in the room right from the moment that the sounds start happening. So who knows, you know. This one that we're working on now, it's coming together pretty quickly, but it'll be a long way off until the final crescendo, just because we're so fanatical. When you've left this incredible treasure trail behind you, we're always, not always looking backwards, but we know we have a sense of trying to, you know, get to that next place, whatever that place might be. So it is increasingly challenging, you know. We don't just bang a song together. It's very, very deliberately kind of thought out without killing the soul and spirit. When you get spontaneous, that's a great feeling. If you can capture that spontaneity, that can be within the song, but what goes around that song can take a while to accomplish at this point, hundreds of songs later. But it works, you know, and it's a joy making this Priest record right now.
We're just happy that there's another Priest record being made right now. I'm being told that we only have time for two more questions. I'm very sorry. Don't shoot the messenger.
All right, I'll be quick. I just want to say, Rob, I've been a fan of yours since late 70s when I was a kid, early 80s growing up with you. Listen, in every kitchen I've ever worked in, I'm a chef now. Everybody
where
in my kitchen.
Where are you a chef at?
Little Jewel of New Orleans, downtown Los Angeles. Grew up in the French Quarter. Always listen to all of your records.
Thank you.
Loudly.
Yes.
In those kitchens.
Yes.
Everyone else has had to endure it, like it or not. I told myself if I ever met you or could talk to you, I'd ask you this question. Obviously, the influences in your music from blues and otherwise are evident. The earlier ones, psychedelic music and such. Are there any genres of music that you listen to that we wouldn't associate with you? Any styles, anything that would surprise us? Rob Halford listens to this that you, most metal fans, would not know.
I think I've probably talked about this before, but I mean, again, I think a lot of musicians will tell you that outside of their own music, it's very important if you have the ability to be very open to listen to all kinds of stuff. So, you know, on my phone, I've got a lot of classical stuff. Tchaikovsky, Beethoven, Sibelius, Mozart, all of that type of beautiful classical music. And then I've got Tammy Wynette.
All right.
Stand by your
You know, and then I've got some Slayer, and then I've got some Whitesnake, and then I've got some Pavarotti, you know, and then I've got some Vivaldi, and I'm all over the place, you know, and that's just... That's just the joy of being a musician. If you're able to soak up all of these different experiences, you can let them kind of filter through into your own work.
Well, thank you for everything.
You. I'm afraid this is the last question, and
so
I'm sorry.
So sorry. I'm an old man, and my brain is starting to go... And I haven't had anything to eat.
I can point out the people
and
for you guys to yell at,
I'm
though.
Dying for a drink, and I want some food. And somebody to tuck me into bed and tell me a bedtime story. That kind of thing. I know you'd say yes, you did. Thank you, Tony. Big Tony. Last one.
Hi, Rob. I'm Sandy. It's such an honor to just talk to you right now. I just want to say thank you for everything, all the music that you've put out. Just put me through, you know, just... through any situation, I just want to thank you for that,
thank
for
you.
All the strength for that. From
thank
that,
you.
I know you have Judas Priest going on right now, and I just want to ask, like, in future, are you gonna go back to Halford? Anything for, like, from that Resurrection album? Anything from that?
I was wondering the same thing.
I'd love to. You know, again, it's all about the timing of everything. I was listening to Resurrection the other day on a flight from. Sioux Falls, South Dakota. I love Sioux Falls, South Dakota. Have you been?
I haven't.
You should go.
But I'm going to.
It's
so.
Great. It's great.
Yeah.
And
literally, we'll be there soon.
So I was listening to Resurrection and that you know, the title cut and Drive and all the other tracks that escape me now. But it's some great songs on there. And I had a really good time making that record, you know, both that and Crucible. And again, it's just finding the opportunity. Yeah, finding the opportunity. I saw Metal Mike recently. He's doing great. I saw, Mark Chossy, who now works for Monster Energy Jinx. Mark was in the Fight Band for a spell. Was it two?
Mark
Chossy. Oh, I can't remember, so many. But if I get the chance, I would like to see what I could do, yeah. But my first love will always be Priest, you know, and, you know, we've got so much work ramping up. Yeah. And with Priest, everything goes in like a three-year cycle, which is crazy, but it is the way it works at this point for a band like Priest. Most bands at this point, it's a three-year cycle because it, you know, from the moment you finish a world tour, which can last 2 years, then you give yourself a bit of time to take a breath. Then you start writing, and then you start recording, and then you do promo, and then he's ready to do a tour, and finish the tour, and there's 3 years of your life gone. You know, so I'm not complaining. I'm just saying that it's trying to find the space for all of those other cool things to happen. But thank you for mentioning that that moment, and maybe it will return. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Fastest question ever. Quick,
thank
go.
You. So I married into metal 26 years ago, and we produced the future of metal now. But my question is, earlier in the interview, you had said that music had transcended throughout time when you had started without the use of technology. Would you say now that technology and social media has produced something positive or negative for the future of metal? And I'd like to say thank you to MI for allowing my family and I to be a part of this amazing interview.
Thank you. Here's the thing. I think if you'd have asked that question to a musician in the 50s, they'd probably say what I'm going to say now, is that, you know, you have to be aware of the advantages of technology. Like I mentioned a bit earlier about when Hendrix was turning things up on them because Jim Marshall made the Marshall amps. You couldn't do that before at that level with that sound. And so that was an advantage that technology can give you. The downside is when you move away from playing in the studio onto tape, reel to reel, you know, and if you fuck up, you have to start again, you know. Now you don't have to do it with Pro Tools, which we all use, even Priest use Pro Tools. So there's this terrible trap you can fall into called cut and paste. You cut and paste things, you know, and you really can take the soul and spirit out of a song by doing that. If you really should, as a musician, just me saying what I want to say, if you should be able to play through the whole thing, you know. I mean, I know when Scott does his drum tracks, he plays through the whole thing, and then he'll play it again. You know, it's the same with me when I do my vocal takes. I'll sing the entire song, take a break for a couple of minutes, and I'll sing it again, you know, and I'll maybe do five or six different takes. And then I might cut and paste if I have to, because, you know, the performance is always, the inflection of a vocal performance should and generally does change from take to take. And you're really looking, trying to get the best out of something. So sometimes I'll cut and paste and put it together, and I go, that's the vocal thing I want to get. And then I'll sing along with that until I get it, and then I'll do it for real, you know, keeping it real. But the thing about cut and paste is that for a younger musician as well, it's like a fast track. It's a fast track to making a song. And, you know, that might be a good thing if you've only got so much money to spend and so much time in the studio, but it can be a bit of a shortcut on your own abilities. You don't know what you can do until you really, you know, get stuck in, you know, and really learn how to play that song all the way through, or see what sometimes, you know, like a mistake or something can make something great out of that type of thing. So just don't be afraid of it, I think. Don't be afraid of the great advantages of technology. And in terms of social media, it's absolutely extraordinary how you can utilize social media and in terms of connectivity to your fans, like with me and my Instagram, at Rob Halford Legacy. it's my only addiction. You know, when you don't drink and drug, you look for the next addiction. I'm fucking addicted to Instagram right now. But anyway, I just wanted to finish that off with something about, it's so hard to be a musician right now. It really is tough. I know it is because I speak to musicians, you know. It's so fucking hard. And I wish you all the blessings in the world because there's so much extraordinary talent here in America particularly that are trying their damnedest to get the break that they truly deserve because they have great things going on. But you're up against this, you know, this thing where there's just no money there now. The finances for a band, you know, it's so difficult for a band just to put one step in front of another to just because of the way that the business side works. You know, if you're lucky to get a deal, you have to literally give everything away, you know. It's terrible. You're giving everything away. And I don't think that's fair, but unfortunately, that seems to be the format. But you know, moving from that depressive tone, what I'm trying to say is that with technology and with social media, there are struggles involved, but there's also the upside and the greatness of it. So, for any musicians here tonight that are, you know, going through that type of challenge, my big thing is, don't give up. Never give up. Never give in. Just keep doing what you do. You know, because, you know, we all want the tour bus. We all want the great things. But the heart of it is, if you're in a band, it's the greatest thing in the fucking world to be in a band. You know, to be with your bandmates, to be jamming. Even if you're just playing one club every month, every whatever, it don't matter. It's the greatest thing in the world. And if you're persistent, if you have something that's fresh and original and attractive, because of social media, particularly in the technology associated with that, you will be discovered, you will be found, you know. Even though you might be awake at night going, we're not going to make it. Well, believe me, if you've got that special something, you will make it. And I just wish you all the luck in the world for getting to that special place. Thank you.
And thank you, everybody here, for coming tonight. I have to say, it's August, which means you have a birthday coming up, I believe. So happy early birthday to you, Mr. Halford. I'm Ryan Downey. This is Rob fucking Halford.
Thank you.
This fucking priest. Thank you, guys.
That does it for this episode of Speak and Destroy. Speak and Destroy episode 4. Speak and Destroy is part of the Pop Curse Podcast Network. Please check out our other podcasts. Pop Curse with Ryan J. Downing, that's me. No Prize from God, conversations about belief, unbelief, and everything in between. And check out the past episodes of Speak and Destroy, episode 1 with M. Shadows of Avenged Sevenfold, episode 2 with Mark Eglinton, author of the new biography on James Hetfield, and episode 3 with Blasco, bassist for Ozzy Osbourne and former longtime bassist for Rob Zombie. Follow Speak and Destroy on Facebook, Instagram, and Speak and Destroy _ on Twitter. Follow me on Twitter at Ryan Downey and on Instagram at Superhero HQ. You guys have been great, and I've been Ryan J. Downing.